Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today on the show, the case of the missing pumpkin. I'll sort out the truth and rumors behind the alleged pumpkin shortage. Can you imagine doctors writing prescriptions for chocolate? A new study says it's not so far off. Plus, the medicinal qualities of the gin and tonic. And Jonathan Gold stops by with a restaurant for us to try. But first, let's see what's in season this week at the Southern California Farmers Markets.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It's the week after Thanksgiving, and we're all trying to get inspired about shopping and cooking for ourselves, of course, from the farmer's market. And we're visiting with C.J. Jacobson. He is the executive chef at The Yard, great little spot right here in Santa Monica, just steps away from the market. And C.J., of course, you're going to hopefully give us some great ideas and a simple recipe we can do at home.
Absolutely. A lot of people love a caprese salad. I kind of don't like it, but I know it's really, really popular. So we've kind of done a play with that with persimmons. We use the brown sugar persimmons from Penryn Orchards. I just cut out the seeds and I kind of sliced them kind of like lengthwise. I stagger that with burrata cheese and pomegranates and smoked almonds. Then just a little bit of balsamic on top and some basil. And it's really an interesting flavor.
Oh, that's fantastic. And the chocolate persimmons from Penryn, they're a smallish persimmon, and they can be eaten hard or soft?
Yeah, that's how I like them. They have really thin skin, and you can eat them firm. And that's why I actually get those variety, because you can slice them firm, and they still have some structure.
Is there a flavor difference between them and a regular persimmon? Why do you pick those? Just because they look so spectacular?
I pick them mostly because they are firm, like a fuyu, but they're more oblong. I think they look cool. And the inside, you know, the chocolate, you know, cocoa-y notes on the inside look really pretty. They can sometimes be a little bit chalky, but if you give them the right time, they're perfect. And they're even good when they're, like, almost completely ripe, because then they just almost look entirely like cocoa on the inside, like brown sugar.
But they're still firm enough to slice.
Yeah. It's a little more challenging. You might get a little more goober on your hand, but you'll work it out.
Aren't there seeds in there? How do you get around those seeds?
What I do is I just slice it right straight down the length of it.
Uh-huh.
And then from there on, it almost guides you to where to cut, because there's kind of like a pulp line, but like a white, lighter line going down the center of it. And you slice down that. Then you slice, just kind of scoop out the seeds from there. You can see them at that point.
Oh, so they're all clustered in one spot.
Well, there's four. There's only four in every persimmon, so you just kind of cut them into quarters, then you just kind of scoop them out like you would an apple almost.
Okay, and now do you roast and toast in your own almonds?
Yeah, we smoke our own almonds with mesquite.
Oh, you smoke them?
Yeah.
Oh, how nice.
That's when the profile is really cool, because you have creamy, sweet, tangy, then smoky.
And once you smoke these almonds whole, then you want to crush them up. How do you do that?
You can either just cut them with your knife or use the flat end of your knife and just kind of smash them.
Oh, sounds just wonderful. And pomegranate seeds, do you have a method for getting those seeds out of there?
There's a lot of different methods. I just kind of lightly slice on the outside and dig my fingers in and pull it open over a bowl of water. Mm-hmm. I like them nice and clean. Some people like to bang the back of them. They get kind of bruised. I like them like as little individual jewels. I think they're more pretty that way.
They are. They're beautiful. Yeah. All right, CJ, well, thank you so much. Thanks for the recipe.
So
all right.
Bye.
That was CJ Jacobson. He is the executive chef at The Yard, which is right here a few steps from the farmer's market. And that's a delicious, seasonally inspired salad, fresh ingredients right from here. We're talking with farmer Alex Weiser. He's at many, many markets. He's, of course, the potato guy most of the year, and then he does melons and tons of stuff. Alex, today I want to talk to you about your sunchokes. And you've got the sign explaining that they are not ginger. You get that a lot.
A lot of people don't know about sunchokes, so they don't know what they're looking at. They assume it's ginger, but it's sunchokes, or also known as Jerusalem artichoke.
It basically looks like a bumpy piece of ginger.
Tuber, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And we also have a red variety, too, but mainly it's this, it's called Stampede, is the white variety. We like calling them sunchokes rather than Jerusalem artichokes because they're actually from the sunflower family. It's a tuber from the sunflower plant.
Uh-huh.
Has nothing to do with Jerusalem or artichokes.
Okay.
It's a true Native American discovered plant. It grows on all types of soil. Actually, it tastes like artichoke heart, I think. Great roasted, raw, pickled, julienned,
mashed. Yeah.
A lot of chefs mix them in mashed potatoes to give it a little extra flavor. It has great flavor. Great to make a vegetable stock because it disintegrates really well in the water. It grows through the summer, and it makes the tubers at the end of the year when the plant's going dormant. And it's a beautiful fall-winter crop that we harvest till spring.
Okay, now there's no way to peel them, and you really don't need to, right?
You know, chefs peel them, but ours are so fresh that I don't. I just scrub them because they do have those nooks and crannies, and you do get dirt sticking to them, but there is a skin to them. If you're going to use them in mashed potatoes or something, you may want to go through the trouble of peeling them.
And then when you store them, when you get home, how would we store them?
Keep them in a Tupperware or a Ziploc bag, and maybe with a moist towelette in there, just to keep them moist and cold.
Okay, in the fridge.
Because if you leave them out, they'll dry out and wither away.
Okay, wonderful.
Another thing I want to say about sunchokes is that they're beneficial for diabetics, people who can't eat too many potatoes, because a starch turns to sugar. Well, with the sunchoke tuber, the starch turns to inulin rather than insulin, so it's safe for diabetics to eat plenty of them.
And they taste like artichoke hearts.
I think that's where they get the artichoke from, yes. Oh. I think it tastes like artichoke hearts, yes.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Alex. And, of course, Alex and his family and his loyal workers sell at about 9 farmers markets here in the L.A. area, so you can catch them pretty much any day of the week all around town. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You can find pictures and recipes of what Laura Avery just talked about at kcrw.com/goodfood. Every week we shoot videos with farmers and chefs at the market. You can watch them all on the Good Food app for your iPhone or iPod Touch, and you can also find them at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you've been to a farmer's market in Los Angeles recently, you've probably seen the white netting draped over displays of fruit. It's there to protect against a Mediterranean fruit fly that's infiltrated Southern California farms. Pomologist David Karp writes the weekly Market Watch column for the Los Angeles Times, and he's here to explain what's going on.
Well, the Mediterranean fruit fly is an exotic pest of great concern to California growers because it lays eggs which turn into worms within the fruit, rendering them unmarketable. They'd be distasteful to any consumer, but particularly commercial growers can't ship them, whether within the United States or particularly abroad. So it's a huge economic problem if it ever becomes established. Most recently, they were discovered close to the KCRW studios at the end of October, where the 10 at the eastern end, 10 meets the eastern end of Santa Monica. As a response to that, the state of California declared a quarantine. It primarily affects farmers markets and homeowners. It affects farmers markets in that growers from outside the quarantine, who are bringing in fruit that itself is not affected where it's being grown, when they take it to farmers markets, they have to do a couple things, and they have to sign compliance agreements with the CDFA and the USDA to ensure that they're doing that. They have to keep that fruit or a few vegetables, tomatoes, eggplant, and peppers. And most fruits are affected with the exception of strawberries, raspberries, blackberries, and a couple of others. Anyway, any of these affected commodities have to be protected on their trucks. How do they do that? Well, one good way is to keep the door closed so that insects can't come in and sting the fruits. But they also have to protect it by like covering it with a tarp or whatever way is approved by the inspectors who are coming around to the markets, working with the farmers to make sure that they're complying with the quarantine. Then, as anybody who's been to any of the markets, and I think there are 17 of them that are impacted in western Los Angeles in the last week or so since the quarantine was declared, the farmers market vendors have to drape insect-proof netting over their stands in such a way that the netting doesn't directly touch the fruit, because that way an insect, if it were touching, an insect could easily sting the fruit through the netting. Obviously, it can't be 100% because, as anybody that's dealt with fruit flies at home, I'm raising my hand right here, it's easy for the insects to sneak through underneath the netting. Now, these quarantines usually last for 3 life cycles. That's hoping that no new discoveries have been made. And how long is that going to be? Well, nobody officially will tell you on the record for that because the life cycles are temperature dependent. If it's hotter, that's different than if they're colder. It usually lasts about 7 or 8, 9 months or something like that. But what consumers need to do, they need to continue supporting farmers, even though the market's not going to look quite as beautiful for the next 7 months or something like that. It's really important to not let the farmers go down the tubes by stopping buying from them. What they do need to do in order to assist in overcoming this bug, and it always has been licked, by the way, it used to be that any ecologically inclined person would compost their or drop into the green bins their vegetable waste, vegetable and fruit waste. Don't do that anymore for any of these host commodities. And a list can actually be found on the CDFA's website. There's some 260 or so, but basically most fruit. So for the time being, double bag those and put them in the black bin. And as soon as the quarantine ceases to be in effect, then you can resume composting. What you should do, in my opinion, is continue to buy, but be very careful to take good care of the produce that you've bought, the host commodities, and consume them within a reasonable period of time, like within less than a week, which will be less than the time it would take for eggs to hatch, and then throw away the waste in a responsible manner.
David Karp is a pomologist and columnist for the LA Times. Read more about the MedFly quarantine at kcrw.com/goodfood. Thank goodness Jonathan Gold isn't under quarantine. I'll be right back with the Pulitzer Prize winner next. You're listening to Good Food on 89.9 KCRW and kcrw.com. Jonathan Gold is here with us today to whet our appetites yet once again. Jonathan, of course, is the writer from the LA Weekly who was awarded the famed Pulitzer Prize. Where are we going today?
Rosemead.
Rosemead. What are we going to eat?
We are going to eat noodles and dumplings.
Where?
At a restaurant called JTYH.
And does it mean something?
Probably it does. I think it's attached to a market also called JTYH, and it may mean something in Chinese that I have no idea.
JTYH. Catchy name. So talk to us about the noodles.
The specialty of this restaurant are knife-cut noodles, which are famous from the, I guess, Shaanxi region of northern China. They were the specialty of a restaurant called Dao Sha that was maybe the first or one of the first restaurants that really got me excited about the San Gabriel Valley almost 20 years ago. They had these noodles with mushu. We all knew mushu pork. Even back then, we knew mushu pork. You know, egg and clouder mushrooms and onions and some other things that are scrambled. And the way we always ate them when we were kids was wrapped up in pancakes. But this was apparently the actual real version of it, which was tossed with these knife-cut noodles. And by knife-cut noodles, I mean they make this giant log of dough, and then the chef sits there with an extremely sharp razor-edged knife and goes...
So it's not like he's making fettuccine. He's not rolling out a sheet, rolling it up, and then slicing it.
No. There are Korean noodles that are similar to this, but these are brawny. I mean, they're thick. You could probably use them as fan belts in your car. They're exactly the thing that, you know, 100 generations of Modenese housewives have run away from in terror. But they are so good. When I originally came across this place, you know, I wrote about it in the Times, I think in 1990. They moved a year or two later to a bigger location in Monterey Park and renamed themselves Heavy Noodling after the head that the copy editor had put on the piece that I had written for the Times. And they served those noodles for a long time, 15, 16, 17 years, until the couple that owned the place, I think, got old and felt that it was time to roll it up. But here they are again.
They got bored?
Maybe they got bored. Maybe the family figured that it was time to get back into the noodle business. But now they're sort of way east in the San Gabriel Valley. And the food, I think, is even better than it was when it was in Monterey Park. In addition to these noodles, which you can get, you know, mushu, or you can get them in this sort of spicy Taiwanese beef broth, or with wontons, or pretty much anything you can do with noodle, you can get with these noodles. They have a very good version of the Shandong-style beef roll that's become a huge favorite, which is to say fried Chinese pancakes rolled around a filling of spiced stewed beef with scallions and homemade sweet bean sauce.
Wow.
It's the size of two burritos. It's absolutely gorgeous.
Wow, that sounds so good.
And they do dumplings. And again, these are not the most gossamer delicate dumplings you've ever had. They're
hearty.
Hearty and sort of thick-skinned. The pan-fried ones are really good. And the ones that are even better than that are bao, which is to say raised yeast buns with meat inside that are fried on a flat top and have this sort of like gossamer, gauzy, crunchy stuff rolling off the sides of them, I guess, where the starchy water has hit the grill.
Wow, that sounds delicious.
It's so good. It tastes like the essence of fried.
Mm, yum. So the specialties are the noodles and the dumplings, right?
Right. And they have other things. They have, which I thought was odd, a selection of Sichuan cold dishes to start with. So if you want like shaved pig's ears or a really good version of the, you know, boiled tripe with chili or other things of that nature, you know, seaweed salad or...
Crunchy gelatinous things.
Crunchy gelatinous cold things, yeah. They're all happy. They're all slithery.
Well, you know, that seems like that goes really well with dumplings.
It does.
It's like fresh and a different texture.
It sort of cuts the richness sometimes if you keep
it around. Yeah, a nice pig's ear will cut the richness of a dumpling. Oh, that's delicious. So is there anything else we should plumb the menu for here at the alphabet named noodle place? They should go back to heavy noodling.
Heavy noodling is a much better name, I think. The lamb noodle soup is very nice. It's a very comforting, very rich, very lamby soup. It's funny. Most of China, they think lamb is kind of disgusting. But in the north, not only do they like lamb, but they like lamb times 10.
Share the name of the restaurant and where we can find it.
The name of the restaurant is JTYH and is at 9425 Valley in Rosemead.
Terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Gold writes the counterintelligence column for the LA Weekly. Directions for JTYH are at kcrw.com/goodfood. Jonathan Gold's restaurant suggestions frequently take us out of our comfort zone. The restaurants and dishes that he recommends force us to put aside our hang-ups and jump right in. The same can be said about my next guest. He calls himself the Shameless Carnivore. I'm your host, Evan Kleiman, and I'll be right back on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com. You have to wonder at an edible organ that's used to describe anger. Of course, I'm talking about that phrase, venting your spleen. What is the spleen, and why should we eat it and other strange innards? Scott Gold is the author of The Shameless Carnivore. Recently, he mused on the subject of offal and the spleen sandwich. Scott, the spleen sandwich?
Oh, yes. It is a heralded tradition in Sicily.
So describe it.
It's really beautiful looking, actually. If you weren't to know what the meat inside of the sandwich was, you'd probably just jump at it with great gusto and relish. It's a small roll, which is a focaccia, but originally it was called a muffaletta, which in Italian means a small sack or a glove. You have the spleen, which is very long cooked, of course. On the inside, pile on top with some very, very creamy ricotta cheese and some grated Romano. And that's it. Very simple. It's actually at this restaurant. We were enjoying it, Ferdinando's Focacceria in Red Hook, Brooklyn. It was an appetizer, but I, you know, had that and one or two other things as my entire entree. So it's this really lovely looking sandwich with really creamy cheese, and the meat is nice and brown, and it's really a thing of beauty.
And what's the origin of the spleen sandwich?
There's a lot of debate to this, to tell you the truth, within food historians. Some people say that it was the Jews that made it popular in Sicily around, I think, 580 BC or so. They were driven out of Judea by the Babylonians. And there's a very similar Jewish dish called the milts or gefilte milts, which is made with spleen, stuffed with bread, onions, eggs, and schmaltz, which is rendered chicken fat. And so one theory is that they brought it to Sicily when they were driven out by the Babylonians, and then the Sicilians adopted it from there, much like a lot of the contributions of Jewish cooking in world cuisine.
When I think about these kinds of meats, I think about poor cooking,
big cuts, big money, little cuts, not a lot of money. And do you find that to be true of most of awful cooking?
Absolutely. It's a poverty food. And the brilliant thing about a lot of these, like the vasteda, which is the spleen sandwich, or if in the Sicilian, I guess you'd say the vasted, and a lot of other, you know, you look in menudo, which is a Mexican tripe soup, and you find a lot of these organs, you know, all over. You look at haggis, things like this. It's poverty food. Obviously, you know, the big cuts, as you say, are very expensive. So in the poorer regions of the world, you'll find very innovative and delicious uses of these poverty meats, of these offal and organs and innards and lungs and spleens and kidneys and, you know, all that stuff that, you know, it seems kind of gross. Literally, offal means offal. It's an old English term that means something that fell off the butcher's table as they were, you know, cutting off the bigger cuts. But the wonderful thing is, over centuries, people learned how to cook these things, not just so that they were edible and nutritious, but so they tasted really, really lovely.
Scott Gold is the author of The Shameless Carnivore. Find a link to his book and to some of his recent articles about eating offal at kcrw.com/goodfood. What's the strangest thing you've ever eaten, and how did it make you feel? Tell me about it. Go to this week's show at kcrw.com/goodfood and scroll down to leave a comment. You might have heard the rumor that there's a pumpkin shortage, but I have to say that wherever I go, I see stacks of the canned squash. So is the shortage real? Or as some have suggested, is it just a claim made during the holidays to drive up sales and prices? Phil Lempert is the supermarket guru. He has answers. So is it real?
Well, Evan, I have to tell you, it is. I've talked to manufacturers about it. I've also been out in the farms talking to farmers. And the problem that we have, and it's not just about pumpkins or squash, but it's about all of produce, is this past year has been devastating to plantings. The weather has been horrible. So really what we're starting to see when it comes to pumpkins is about a month ago, 6 weeks ago, that's when the shortage was. That was before the new crop actually got canned. So today, and probably through, you know, the rest of January, we're going to have plenty of pumpkins on the shelf. But as you pointed out, the prices are slightly higher. And what I've been telling people is search online for the best price. You might have to buy a case of pumpkin, but at least you're going to get a good price and you're going to get the quantity.
So when we are buying pumpkin in the can this year, these pumpkins were actually harvested the year before, right?
Exactly.
So what are they predicting for next year?
Next year should be fine. There shouldn't be a shortage. All things being equal, the plantings that have taken place so far in the past 2 or 3 months have been on schedule. And unless we have some severe weather problems come January, February, March, the season should be fine next year.
Now, just out of curiosity, what percentage of the market does Libby's have?
Oh, from what I gather, it's well over 90%. And also keep in mind that most stores don't even stock canned pumpkin year-round. So it's a very small niche market, and it's owned by one player.
So do you suggest that we stock up?
I don't. To be honest with you, unless you really love pumpkin throughout the year, I don't think you have to. It's not that expensive. And keep in mind that if you're buying it now and you're going to keep it for another year, you're tying up that money. So I don't think that when it comes to pumpkin, you really have to stock up.
Do you have any idea if it was just a pumpkin shortage or were other squashes short as well?
According to Libby's, it was just the pumpkin. However, again, if we take a look at what's gone on this past year, we've seen shortages in a whole bunch of different naturally grown produce items. And I do think we are, even though prices have come down over the past 9 months or so, I think middle of next year, we're going to see food prices rise again. And frankly, we're going to see this happen time and time again over the next decade until we can really figure out how we should be, you know, growing products where we can do it without any problems with the weather. I was just up in the Ojai area last week and visited some tomato farms that are all hothouse tomatoes. We don't have to worry about the weather. And it was about 30 acres of hothouse tomatoes.
Wow. Well, that's amazing. Yeah, I would imagine that the whole drought and water shortages are going to really impact prices on produce.
No question about it. And keep in mind, when it comes to produce, it also affects wheat, also affects corn. That goes into, you know, the feed for chickens and for hogs and for cows. That means those prices are going to go up as well. So I think that 2010, we're going to see some huge price increases again.
Well, thank you so much, Phil.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Phil Lempert is known as the supermarket guru. Find more about him and find a few articles about the pumpkin shortage at kcrw.com/goodfood. Coming up, a woman leads a group of volunteers to her native Puerto Rico to bring it back from the culinary brink. It's a foodie rescue mission. That's in 1 minute right here on KCRW and kcrw.com. I spent some time in Puerto Rico with friends who lived there, and I was appalled at the state of the food, where I expected small organic farms supplying farmers markets with really interesting local foodstuffs. There was little to be had, and when I started to ask questions, a complex and sad set of situations were revealed. It's as if the worst of the American food system has been visited upon this beautiful island and its lovely people. Culinary Corps is the Peace Corps for professional chefs, with an initial focus on New Orleans and the Mississippi Gulf Coast after Katrina. But Viviana Acosta Padial saw a need in her native country, Puerto Rico. So what's the focus of the upcoming Culinary Corps outreach trip to Puerto Rico?
Culinary Corps, it just seems like such a perfect fit for Puerto Rico because food is such an important part of our culture and it's such a great source of pride for us because it does set us apart from the rest of the nation and other neighboring islands. And we do express ourselves through our food and communicate well using it. But, you know, unfortunately, we have been facing some struggles in terms of preserving and passing on these local traditions and ingredients. Sustainable economic development remains a challenge for us because U.S. influence and industrialization have eroded the viability of agriculture in the island. We depend largely on food imports, so maybe that's why your experience was a little bit iffy. There has been a struggle in the past 10 to 15 years from local farmers, small, you know, individuals that have been trying to resurrect this sector of the economy in terms of agriculture. But there is still a lot of work to be done. So Culinary Corps comes in, and it's basically going to build on that testament of our individuality through our food. We're going to be working with different organizations, building community through the table, so that we can hopefully, you know, reinforce this this source of pride for the community. Because we all know that a proud nation is on its way to great things.
We should say that Puerto Rico is a U.S. Commonwealth. What's the average income?
The average income is about $10,000 to $12,000 per household. So we do have a slightly lower income than Mississippi. So it is a pretty low median income.
So that means that a lot of the people there are dependent on federal aid.
That's correct. There is a welfare state in Puerto Rico, and it is an issue, you know, that creates certain struggles with the sense of identity for our people. We're often misunderstood in that sense, and we often misunderstand ourselves because of that.
So what are you going to do, actually? What is Culinary Corps going to do during the days that you're there?
Well, we are lucky and honored to be working with some great nonprofit organizations in the island that have been working, you know, to improve the quality of life of or certain sectors of our community, mostly those that face hardship, you know, domestic abuse and long-term illnesses. So, for example, we're going to be working one day in Vieques, which is one of our adjacent islands on the East Coast. So we're going to go in and working with Vidas, which is an Episcopal Social Service organization, and they work with early childhood intervention, you know, through creating and managing positive learning spaces and experiences. Culinary Corps is going to come in, and we're going to create a healthy cooking workshop for the kids. It's going to be called Saboreando el Arcoiris. It translates to savoring the rainbow. So we're going to be exploring vegetables and fruits that represent the colors of the rainbow. And then the students and their families, because we want the families to be present, to turn it, these ingredients to simple, kid-friendly dishes, smoothies, wraps, etc. So that's one of the projects. Another day, we're going to be working with Sapientis. Sapientis is an educational program that encourages self-respect and community leadership for youth at risk in Puerto Rico. You know, they deal a lot with school desertion. And one of the schools they work with, Albert Einstein School in Barrio Obrero, which is an underserved sector of San Juan, they have a three-year baking and pastry program. So it just fit like a glove. So we're going to be coming in, working with 10th, 11th, and 12th graders and creating a pasta workshop, teaching the kids to make pasta from scratch. And then they are working on a chef garden in the school. So when we come, we're going to be teaching them how to create wonderful, delicious marinara sauce from the ingredients they are planting in the garden.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much, Viviana.
Oh, you're very welcome, Evan.
I traveled to Puerto Rico this summer, and I've posted pictures of my trip. See them at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can find out more about the Culinary Corps there, too. I'm not really one for super sweet, fruity drinks. So when I went to Puerto Rico, I drank gin and tonics, which, of course, raised some eyebrows. Just what is this distilled spirit and where did it come from? David Wondrich is the co-founder of the Museum of the American Cocktail in New Orleans. Let's start with the absolute basics. What kind of spirit is it? Is it a grain-based spirit?
That's a good question right there. It used to be a grain-based spirit, but people have made gin out of almost anything. The thing about gin is it's a flavored spirit. And usually, the way we understand it in modern times anyway, it's been a flavored neutral spirit. So it's just like vodka. You can make it out of anything. You strip all the flavor out first, and then you add your own flavors afterwards.
And those flavorings we often call botanicals, right?
Exactly, yes.
So when I think of gin, I think of juniper. Could you describe what juniper is and sort of tell us why when we think of gin, we think of juniper so often?
Well, juniper was the original flavor of gin. That was when gin began, it was a Dutch invention, and they used to take what was basically raw whiskey that they made there. They would distill malt and inefficient old-fashioned stills and flavor it with these juniper berries, which are the berries of an evergreen bush. A lot of people, when they smell gin, they get the scent of pine, and that's not coincidental.
Is it true that it was originally flavored with turpentine?
Some cheap gins made in England for the, let's say, domestic market in the 18th century, which was really the kind of the urban poor and the underclasses, they were flavored with turpentine because it was cheap and piney.
Wow. And
again, you know, they had no Pure Food and Drug Act then.
Really, really awful to imagine drinking alcohol mixed with turpentine.
A poisonous brew. Yeah.
So these days, gin has gone way beyond juniper. What are some other botanicals that are often added to modern gins?
Coriander is one of the big ones, which adds a lemoniness to it. Angelica root adds a little earthiness. Orris root, also earthiness. Various citrus peels will be mixed in. And those are all very traditional. There are a couple other spices that turn up. Cubeb turns up sometimes. But lately, people have been experimenting with a lot of other stuff.
Like what?
Grape blossoms, cucumber comes in and some rose petals.
Now, I lately have been reading also about Genever. Now, what's the difference between gin and Genever?
Well, that was the Dutch forefather of gin, and it's basically flavored whiskey, where modern gin, London dry gin, is flavored vodka. The base spirit is different. In modern London dry gin, the spirit has that it's based on has been filtered and distilled to very high proof, so it's very pure, clean, and neutral. The Dutch, on the other hand, make it almost like malt whiskey, like you'll get in Ireland or Scotland, and then they add the flavoring to that. So it's a very different spirit.
Wow, that must really be aromatic.
It's aromatic, but it's also very malty. You know, it's kind of rich and a little bit thick and textured. It works great in some drinks and mixes, and others it really clashes. So it's you have to mix with it a little more carefully. You can't put it into every gin drink and have it work.
What are some gins that seem to be very popular now?
Well, you've got the big sellers like Beefeater and Tanqueray, both of which I think are very well made. Plymouth is very hip right now because it's an old gin, but it's also light and mixable. You have Hendrick's, which is very popular, and that's a real category changer. That's what the first of the true modern style gins. That's the one that introduced cucumber and rose petal, but very subtly. Then you've got all kinds of new ones that are getting attention. Aviation from the Pacific Northwest is a eccentric and kind of cool one. It's kind of thick and very herbal, kind of like a potpourri flavor.
So the gin and tonic, that drink that I enjoy so much during the summer, which I think really needs a very juniper-driven gin, what is its origin?
In India and places like South Africa, basically in the warmer parts of the world in the 19th century, people took quinine water to avoid malaria because it was the only effective thing we had then. And they were drinking gin, so it was a natural thing to mix the gin and the tonic water. And it really started kind of independently. The Dutch were doing it, and the English were doing it out east in Asia. And it wasn't really until the 1920s that it spread to the U.S. It was a late arrival on our shores.
David Wondrich is the co-founder of the Museum of the American Cocktail in New Orleans. At kcrw.com/goodfood, I've got some cocktail recipes using gin. So are you a gin or a vodka person? Seems like you're either one or the other. Fess up. Leave a comment on the show's page at kcrw.com/goodfood. Click on latest show and scroll down to leave your vote. Come on, gin lovers, represent. Lucky for us, we don't have to go far to taste the cuisines of the world. To eat like Bolivians, we just have to head down the 405 to Tustin in Orange County. Let's take a drive with Gustavo Arellano. That's next, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Gustavo Arellano, food editor for the OC Weekly, has dropped by the studio today to entice us to try another great ethnic meal in Orange County. I'm excited about where we're going today.
We are going to Rolly's Bakery in the city of Tustin.
And what can we expect there?
Rolly's Bakery is one of the very few restaurants in Southern California that sells Bolivian food.
So it's not just a bakery.
It's half Mexican, half Bolivian. The wife's Mexican-American, the husband's Bolivian. And honestly, I'm sure the Mexican food is good at Rolly's Bakery. I've never tried it, except for the pan dulce. The pan dulce there, it's really excellent. And what I like about the pan dulce there, they give you a little guide that tells you the name of all the different pan dulces. Because even myself as a Mexican, sometimes I wonder, what's that one called that's pink and brown? And what's the other one? Even my parents don't know about it. So at the very least, you you could go there and steal a whole bunch of the guides and then take them to another panaderia.
What is pan dulce? Oh,
pan dulce is Mexican sweetbread. You have the conchas. Everyone knows the conchas. When your Mexican coworkers bring Mexican sweetbreads for Christmas, they're probably giving you those conchas, which I like to say look like an armadillo that has that ridged back with granulated sugar on it. They could be pink. It could be strawberry-flavored, chocolate-flavored. And empanadas, of course, are the famous one. Turnovers stuffed with apple or pineapple or vanilla cream. And then the rest of them are just really ripoffs of the French. So we don't have to talk about
Not
those.
Always. There's sometimes some really incredible sweet cheese breads.
That's really good.
Sometimes there's incredible, like, cheese and guava paste pastries.
We stole that from the Cubans. No, it's pan dulces are wonderful, and Rolly's does do a great job of selling them. But really, you come here, you order some of those to go, but you go there to eat Bolivian food.
What is Bolivian food?
The most famous Bolivian dish is a salteña. This is the king of all empanadas. So imagine something as probably as big as a baseball, but shaped like a little football, this cute little knot going lengthwise of it. And inside the salteña, you have ground beef or ground chicken. You could order either of them. You have chopped up peas, carrots, raisins, a little bit of some nuts, some cinnamon. And the best thing about the salteña, it actually has broth inside.
Wow.
It has broth inside. So you have to eat this with a spoon. You have to crack it open, almost like a chicken pot pie. You have to crack it open, let it cool down a little bit, because if you try biting, I know this from experience, if you try biting it, just grabbing it by both of your hands and biting it, it's going to scald you. So you have to crack it open. And of course, the crust is so flaky, so buttery, just so gorgeous. And inside, oh, I forgot the hard-boiled egg. That's also inside as well.
So it's a meal encased in a dough.
A meal encased in a dough. One of them costs about $2. Two of them will fill you up completely. And so you go home for about $5. And there's only – in salteñas, they're really hard to find. Again, there's not that many Bolivian restaurants. So you could go here, order a bunch of them to go, eat one right there. But remember, the spoon. Don't scald yourself.
What else is on the Bolivian menu?
Bolivia is an Andean country, so you could expect different types of potatoes. You have purple potatoes. You have chuño, which is – freeze-dried potatoes, which to me kind of tastes like grits a little bit, except encased in these small little slices. One of my favorite dishes is called a silpancho, which is basically a Milanese-style cut, this humongous, thin beef slice, about as big as a plate. And what I love about that, slightly breaded, a little bit saltier than usual chicken-fried steak, but then they prepare two eggs over easy on top of that silpancho.
Just in case you need a little more protein.
Yeah, it makes a chicken fried steak taste as austere as a tofu block. And then you have the rice on the side, you have some potatoes on the side, and the ají, of course, ají being the Andean version of a salsa, much thicker, it's not as spicy, but it does have this little kick to it. You have another soup made from peanut stock. It's basically a peanut stew with beef inside of it. And whatever you do, whenever you go there, you have to order a drink called, it has a strange name for a Mexican like me, mocochinchi. Moco in Mexican Spanish means booger. But it's not that. It's not that. Mocochinchi.
Thank you for that information.
You know what? When I first read it, when I first saw the name of it, I had to wince a little bit. But it really is, it's peach juice. Peach juice spiked with cinnamon, served cold with a full peach inside.
That's extraordinary.
Oh, my God. It is good. It is one of the best ethnic juices I've ever tasted. You could also get, you know, because and I had never tasted it before. In the Andean countries, they're famous for their chichas, chicha morada, which is made from purple corn.
Corns, yeah.
Yeah, corns or passion fruit maracuya. They have those there, but you have to get the mocochinchi because at the very least you have this chilled peach inside that you just scoop out and it's almost like syrup at that point.
Wow. This is the kind of place that you have to go to with a lot of people so everybody can order something different.
You do. And that's a great thing about this restaurant is that it has about 15 to 16 entrees as is. And the owners, they're not done yet. The last time I went there, they were still in the process of getting their liquor license. They were going to start selling Bolivian beers and Bolivian wines. And the owners, they just want to really make it the epicenter of Bolivian life in Southern California. And what better place to do that than in Orange County, which has the largest population of Bolivians in Southern California.
Unbelievable. So interesting. Such a different, every time you come, it's just such a different view of Orange County than the one we usually hear about.
Don't watch those horrible television shows. Just read the OC Weekly. That's all you need to know about the real Orange County.
Thank you very much, Gustavo.
Un placer always.
Find directions to Rolly's Bakery and Tustin at kcrw.com/goodfood. All of Gustavo's restaurant suggestions are on a map. You can find it on the Good Food blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. That chocolate bar you're about to eat, it just might save your life. Well, okay, I might be exaggerating a little. Next on Good Food, is prescription chocolate in our future? That's ahead. Stay tuned. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. You've probably heard that chocolate is good for you, what with all the antioxidants and everything. But chocolate as medicine? Yes, it's true. A new study says that if people who have had heart attacks eat a couple pieces of chocolate a week, they can reduce the risk of dying. Dr. Ken Mukamal is a researcher at Ben Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, and he co-authored the study.
We were interested in understanding how nutritional factors, parts of diet, might affect people following a heart attack. Following on the idea that we know a good bit about what might lead to the risk of having a heart attack, but a lot less about what to do once somebody's had one. In this particular case, we were particularly interested in chocolate because of the really very interesting and I think pretty well established effects of chocolate in small short-term studies on things like blood pressure and so on. And so we wanted to extend that to see whether those might also lead to differences in mortality amongst people who had heart attacks.
So what was the result?
Well, we looked at two primary outcomes, sort of how many people died overall and how many people specifically died from heart disease after their heart attack. For total mortality, for all causes of death, we didn't see a big difference. And that's not necessarily a surprise because we wouldn't necessarily expect chocolate to affect every single way that people die. On the other hand, specifically for cardiac mortality, for people who died from heart disease, we saw quite a strong effect, so that the more chocolate people seem to eat, the lower the risk of dying from heart disease after their heart attack.
That is just so amazing. Did you manage to come up with a serving suggestion, like how many servings a week and how large?
I think it's important to keep in mind to start off with that these were people who were enrolled in a study of heart attacks in Stockholm. So we collected almost every case of heart attack that occurred in Stockholm in a defined period of time. But this is also fundamentally about Swedish chocolate, which tends to have a higher cocoa content than what we might get in the States. So keeping that in mind, the lowest risk seemed to be people who were eating chocolate twice or more per week. So I think that kind of recommendation, having chocolate, say, as an after-dinner snack two or three times a week, probably about the right amount.
And we're talking about chocolates that have a very high content of cocoa powder, so they would be the higher percent chocolates that we see here in the States.
That's exactly right. The very simple, very milky, light chocolates that we get don't have a lot of cocoa content in them relative to the darker, somewhat more bitter, more powerful chocolate that you would get, say, throughout Europe. So when looking at our results, it's important to keep that in mind because I don't think that this is necessarily generalizable to all kinds of chocolate, but probably reflects something about the antioxidants in cocoa in particular.
So if it's about antioxidants, could we just eat a ton of blueberries?
We haven't looked at blueberries in this particular case yet, but the answer is probably no. There probably are differences between antioxidants. We've tended in the past to lump all antioxidants together, but I think that when we've seen, for example, for things like vitamin E, that's probably not a good idea. There probably are differences between antioxidants, and the particular kinds of antioxidants in chocolate seem to be particularly effective in A, improving the function of our blood vessels, and B, in reducing our blood pressure. That's probably not the case for every kind of antioxidant.
And up to how much was the risk lowered?
In our study, it was lowered quite dramatically. So about 60% or almost 70% lower risk amongst those who are eating the most chocolate compared to those who are eating the least. But again, keeping in mind what we discussed earlier, it's impossible to be 1,000% sure that we've accounted for every way in which chocolate eaters and non-eaters might differ. So although in this case, it was a very dramatic difference, about 65 or 70% lower risk. In reality, I would suspect that if we were able to account for everything perfectly, the lower risk might not be that great.
Do you think, given its effectiveness that you've seen in a post-heart attack situation, that we could perhaps stave off having heart attacks by consuming it before that happens?
You know, it's a great question, and I think it was much of what led us to this work in the first place. In similar sorts of studies in which people have looked at chocolate or some of the antioxidants in chocolate, in similar sort of prospective studies, similar sorts of studies following people forward in time, and chocolate indeed does tend to be associated with a lower risk of a first heart attack. The differences in that case tend to be something in the range of about 20% lower risk. So it's, which I think is perhaps a more plausible degree of risk reduction. So I think we could safely say that, again, if we're looking for sort of a healthy, reasonable snack to be enjoying after dinner, that a little bit of dark chocolate, again, keeping in mind a little bit, would be a really good choice.
Dr. Ken Mukamal is a researcher at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, and he co-authored the study. You can read more about the study at kcrw.com/goodfood. If you've ever eaten at my restaurant, Angeli Cafe, you know that I cook in the rustic Italian style, and presentation in the rustic sense is more, well, freeform. So meeting Robert Wemishner, author of The Dessert Architect, was like being in Bizarro World. He elevates the plating and presentation of dessert to an art form.
Hi, Evan. Great to be here.
When you're looking to put the elements together on the plate, what do you look at in terms of texture, temperature? What are the different elements that have to come together?
You know, it's so important. In my book, we're talking about the cornerstones of a good dessert, and those are flavor first, the primacy of flavor, texture, temperature, and then the contrast. And contrast might be in temperature, it may be in flavor, it may be in texture. And all of those interplaying elements make for the exciting experience on the plate. So what I'm looking for when I plate a dessert is that each element supports each other element, that there isn't a discordant note, that something really doesn't belong, that as you taste this sauce and then taste a piece of the mousse or cake or layered, whatever it is, with it, that you find something unpleasing about it. Everything must harmonize.
When you take a person, a home baker or a pastry student who knows the basics,
right,
and they're able to produce a pretty delicious dessert,
right,
how do you start moving them on the road to plating? What is the first thing that you start to learn?
You know what I think is so important? Tasting. This is something that I think chefs in general, even you know, at a high level, who perhaps have, you know, gotten maybe a little lazy.
They've tasted enough.
They've tasted enough, and you've got to keep tasting constantly. So as I would teach a student, taste each element by itself, taste each element with, you know, the next element, and add one more if, in fact, there are several elements on the plate. Taste in sequence, you know, and make decisions as you go along. And then finally, when all the elements are together in front of you, taste them together. Secondly, we have to look at quantities. The dessert cannot overwhelm us. I mean, how many times do you go out to a restaurant and, you know, and you're just, you know, you're blown away by the quantity that's on the plate. You just sort of turned off. So I think it's very important to be judicious about how much is on the plate. So let's look at how it fits on the plate. What size plate? What dimensions of the plate? What shape plate? Look at all that in terms of visuals. Beyond that, we need to be sure that as we add one more element to the plate, that we're not overwhelming the main element.
Let me ask you, you talk about shape of plate. Does our dessert need to mirror the shape of a plate? So round with round, square with square?
Not necessarily. I think contrast can be great. But what I do say in the book, again, is, and I believe it firmly, is that you need to allow the dessert to breathe on the plate. There needs to be a nice, undecorated, open space as a canvas upon which the dessert is placed. So I don't want to see the plate filled with all kinds of elements. I want to see some open space so that my eye can rest as I put the fork down in front of the dessert that I'm eating and then take the next bite. And then, you know, there's still some empty space. You need that. It opens your palate because you have an eye that's open as well.
Let's talk about temperature contrast, one of the sort of most prevalent contrasts of temperature would be like a warm piece of pie and a little bit of ice cream.
Yeah, the best classical use, absolutely.
But what are some sort of newer, more sort of cutting-edge uses of temperature?
You know, I think temperature, it's interesting. I make a milk chocolate-based mousse that has a crunchy layer of peanut butter and what's called croquentine, but think of it as sort of a sugar cone broken up into pieces, perhaps a little more delicate than that, though. And for that, I serve it with a warm tamarind sauce.
Ooh.
So that tamarind, you know, has that beautiful tart fruitiness that plays well against the milk chocolate. But in the middle of this mousse is this crunchy layer, which even though the mousse is well chilled, it will be still more yielding than that crunchy layer, which will not melt down as fast. So there we have temperature playing its role in creating textural contrast. The sauce is smooth, but it's served warm. So as you dip the mousse into the warm tamarind sauce, it, of course, melts the mousse a little, and that also helps to create some interest.
As I was paging through the book, I came upon a dessert that you make with Ras Malai. Ras Malai is a traditional Indian sweet. Could you describe it and talk about why you like to use it?
You know, it too is texture and it's sweetness that's sort of highly evolved in a way. It's milk that has been boiled down so that we're concentrating the sugars, naturally occurring sugars in the milk. We're adding some processed sugar as well. And it becomes kind of a soft, curded, almost like ricotta texture, but a little firmer, drier than that. And I love it with pistachios, but what I do in this particular dessert is I put it in a Florentine shell. So it's a very thin, crunchy, nutted cookie bowl, if you will, that contains the cooked down milk and some of the sauce, which is milk-based as well. Cardamom, of course, you know, sings loudly in this dessert. All these Indian flavors are classics for a reason. They work so wonderfully well.
Thank you so much, Robert.
Oh, this has been great.
KCRW.com/goodfood has pictures of Robert Wemishner's incredibly artistic desserts. I've got a recipe there as well. You can podcast or download this show, find all past episodes and lots of cooking and video tips at KCRW.com/goodfood. Sign up for our weekly newsletters there too. There's great info, recipes, videos, and pictures on the Good Food blog at kcrw.com/goodfood. And of course, you can spend time with your food friends on Facebook. Follow my fan page there. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. Harriet Els produced and edited the program with Bob Carlson, Connie Alvarez, Candace Moyer, Holly Carson, and Jillian Ferguson. Thanks to Darby Maloney. I'm Evan Kleinman. See you next week for another edition of Good Food.